Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This series contains adult language and depictions of graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised. On the northern bank of the River Thames, just west of Kensington, is the West London district of Hammersmith. Today, Hammersmith is a vibrant community, a major commercial center and bustling transportation hub for the greater London area. All that remains, though, of the original Hammersmith village is a short, narrow alley along the river with an ancient pub called the Dove. Throughout the 1930s, the original layout of the village, along with nearly all of the structures, was demolished to build the modern city. But in 1804, Hammersmith was something of an isolated, poor, working-class community about 5 miles outside of London proper. Back then, not just Hammersmith, but all of Britain, was a deeply religious community, often trespassing into the realm of superstition. On the evening of January 3rd, 1804, a local mason and plasterer named Thomas Millwood was heading home from work in the early darkness of the winter evening. He made for an interesting sight, at least for those unaware of his profession. Much like commercial painters of today, the work uniform of plasterers in the 1800s consisted of white pants, white shirt, and a white apron or light white work jacket. Why white? The same reason painters wear white. The plaster Mr. Millwood worked with every day was white, and therefore wouldn't show up on his clothes as easily. It allowed for a more professional appearance. Especially on the days near the end of a job, when the time came to sand the plaster smooth. He often left work completely covered in fine white plaster dust. Welcome back to The Devil Within. You're listening to The Hammersmith Ghost. We need to back up a bit to the spring of 1802, when a local blacksmith, the occupation for which the town got its name, a local blacksmith succumbed to an undiagnosed mental illness and tragically killed himself. Fearing for his mortal soul and public shame, his faithful wife claimed it was an accident in the forge that killed her husband. Back then, victims of suicide were buried in a lonely graveyard at a crossroads outside of town, the belief being that the soul of someone who takes their own life wouldn't be able to find rest if the body were buried in the consecrated ground of a church. The good wife, however, stuck to her story and saw to it that her husband received the proper Christian burial that he deserved as a lifelong man of God. But as she transitioned into the mourning period of the next few months, she was struck with the abject guilt and heavenly fear of trying to pull a fast one on the Almighty. Stories of a ghost haunting the churchyard began to circulate, and the terrified widow knew it could only mean one thing. Her late husband's soul was denied at the pearly gates and was now forced to haunt the poor village of Hammersmith. Word got out that it was the unsettled soul of a suicide victim. Gasp! buried in consecrated ground that was now on the loose, and the sightings poured in, with each getting more outlandish than the last. In the first incident, a young man named Thomas Groom was cutting through the churchyard on his way home from work when he testified that he was, quote, seized about the throat from behind by an unseen force. When he wrenched his body free and turned around to confront his attacker, he saw only a white mist in the vague form of a person. When he swung at this mist to protect himself, he remarked that it felt as if he were merely pushing against a coat, as if it were hung on a wire. A few weeks later, just after Thanksgiving in 1803, two women were walking along the cobblestones towards the river, enjoying the chill of the late autumn evening. As they passed the graveyard on the grounds of the church, they were allegedly set upon by a vicious specter, appearing as a faceless, floating apparition with flowing white garments. It reached out to seize the women, who promptly screamed and ran for their lives. They were so affected by the encounter that, it was reported, they both died of shock within 48 hours. And then there's the critical case of William Girdler. Mr. Girdler was a night watchman, standing his post at a rye warehouse on the evening of December 29th, 1803. It was sometime in the pre-dawn hours that Mr. Girdler claims to have witnessed an apparition, similar in appearance to the previous sightings, as it made its eerie way along Beaver Lane near the churchyard. Determined to protect his community, Mr. Girdler gave chase to the ghost until, according to him, the specter threw off its ghostly garments and disappeared. Concerned citizens, awoken by the activity, soon found a distressed and excited Mr. Girdler, who explained to them what had just happened. And this is where the hysteria begins to take hold. Mr. Girdler's claims that the apparition, quote, threw off its ghostly garments, greatly interested the townsfolk of Hammersmith, and, since there were no garments to be found anywhere on the ground, that was taken as proof that Mr. Girdler spoke the truth. The garments surrendered by the ghost were obviously not of this world and would therefore not be present at the scene. Rock-solid proof. As the hysteria grew, the situation became more dangerous because of a simple fact. There was no organized police force in Hammersmith at the time. So, in the grips of irrational fear, the townspeople did what humans do. They overreacted. Armed groups of vigilante ghost hunters were formed that began to patrol the town. And no one was safe. One of these concerned citizens was a man named Francis Smith. Smith was well known in the community due to his position as the village excise officer, or tax collector. On the evening of January 3rd, 1804, Mr. Smith was leading one of these vigilante patrols when he happened upon Mr. Girdler at his post at the warehouse on Beaver Lane. Mr. Smith was armed with the weapon of the day, an interesting firearm called a blunderbuss. Okay, a blunderbuss is basically a precursor to the modern shotgun. They were single shot with a flintlock firing mechanism that fired large caliber projectiles through a goofy looking flared barrel that looks more like a trumpet than a rifle. But man, were they dangerous. Because of the flare at the end of the barrel, you could basically shove anything down there and it would become lethal shrapnel. Anyway, Francis Smith, with his blunderbuss, met William Girdler at work, and the men agreed to meet up after 11 p.m. to look for the ghost together. However, just after 11 p.m., Smith caught sight of the ghost turning a corner less than 50 yards ahead of his position. The apparition seemed wholly unconcerned that it had been spotted. Its speed never increased as to make it seem like it was trying to flee or evade capture. Francis Smith took cover behind the corner of a building. After a few moments, with his heart nearly beating out of his chest, he dared a glance in the direction of the ghost and watched as it disappeared down an alley, its flowing white garments seeming to leave a trail of mist in their wake. Francis Smith summoned his courage. This was as terrified as he'd ever been in his life, and he set off alone to face the Hammersmith ghost once and for all. Now let's just get in front of this. For some reason, Smith and the other vigilantes in town were convinced that a firearm would somehow be an effective weapon against a cursed spirit that had taken spectral form in the earthly plane of existence. But alas, Francis Smith charged ahead with his blunderbuss. He crossed the darkened streets of Hammersmith, focused on the alleyway where the ghost had retreated. Once arrived, he took a deep breath and rounded the dark alley, where he saw, not 20 feet in front of him, the very ghost he sought. The undead spirit that had been terrorizing the village. He seemed to have startled it, for it was frozen to the spot, no longer floating freely through the night. But Francis wouldn't be fooled, and certainly wasn't going to allow the demon to get away. In the few seconds since getting his prey within sight, he raised his blunderbuss while shouting, "Damn you! Who are you, and what are you?" Instead of responding, the ghost took a step toward Mr. Smith. In that moment, Smith shouted the command, "Stop or I'll shoot!" while simultaneously discharging his blunderbuss. No doubt scared shitless, and maybe a little curious if his weapon would actually have any effect on a ghost. But still, Francis Smith gave this, quote, ghost no chance to follow his stop or I'll shoot command. He fired while shouting it. And the end result was that the blunderbuss dropped that wicked ghost like a bag of dirt. Absolutely thrilled to have accomplished his task of actually, I guess, killing a ghost, Smith approached the body, only to realize that the ghost was actually the local plasterer. Still dressed in his lily-white uniform with all exposed skin covered in a thin layer of white plaster dust. Well, shit, that's a problem, thought Francis. Presently, his friend, the night watchman William Girdler, heard the shot and came running along with a handful of other vigilantes. All were giddy with the prospect that the ghost had actually been killed. But they, too, realized rather quickly that things had gotten way out of hand. Thomas Millwood, the mason and plasterer, was dead in the streets of Hammersmith, mistaken for a ghost because he was dressed in white. Now, instead of going home to his wife, he was bleeding out with the lower left quarter of his face missing, blown off by a close-range attack from a blunderbuss. Smith was advised to return home and await the local constable, who would surely be interested in talking to him. Millwood's body was taken to a local pub, the Black Lion, where he was laid out to await examination by a surgeon as soon as one could be summoned. 3 days later, on January 6, 1804, Dr. Flower arrived from London to conduct his examination. His findings were a surprise to exactly no one. The cause of death was, quote, a gunshot wound on the left side of the lower jaw with small shot, about size number 4, one of which had penetrated the vertebrae of his neck and injured the spinal marrow. The coroner's report should have read, mistaken for a ghost and shot in the face by a local superstitious idiot. As predicted by the mob that night, law enforcement indeed tracked down Francis Smith and charged him with willful murder. The deceased's wife and sister both testified at the trial. They heard the whole thing as the attack occurred mere feet from Millwood's front door. The sister provided the ear witness report regarding the simultaneous warning to stop, along with the fatal shot from Smith's blunderbuss. But it was the wife who filled in some of the blanks that existed in the months leading up to the tragedy. She testified that she had repeatedly implored her husband to wear a dark-colored coat over his work clothes. He had scared several people who mistook him for the damn ghost. And one of these encounters nearly became violent. Here's a portion of her testimony. Quote, "On Saturday evening, he and I were at home. He said he had frightened two ladies and a gentleman who were coming along the terrace in a carriage, for the man had said, he dared to say, 'There goes the ghost.' And then Thomas said he was no more a ghost than he was and asked him, using a bad word, did he want a punch in the head? I begged of him to change his dress. 'Thomas,' says I, 'as there is a piece of work about the ghost and your clothes look white, pray put on your greatcoat that you may not run into any danger.'" Many of Francis Smith's friends took the stand as character witnesses in an attempt to sway the jury away from conviction. But the facts were the facts, and it wasn't looking good for Francis. Thomas Millwood was unarmed, a working man, a productive member of their community. But still, the jury was reluctant to convict Francis Smith. They all understood the fear that the presence of a ghost conjured up. Everyone was feeling it in a way we may not fully comprehend in today's world. Remember, back then, the Anglicans, or the Church of England, was the only real authority besides the king. People were highly religious and believed in all sorts of paranormal activities as part of accepted reality. Ghosts were real. Curses were real. Astrology was still widely practiced and given credence. Fortune tellers, mystics. So the members of the jury understood where Francis Smith was coming from. But also, given a number of weeks for things to settle down and to really think about what happened, he completely overacted and probably should be punished for it. So they hedged and came back with a verdict of manslaughter, much less severe than willful murder. They honestly believed that Francis actually thought he was slaying a ghost. He had no quarrel with Thomas Millwood. He had never even met the man. Francis legitimately believed he was face to face with a wandering spirit of a suicide victim that had been attacking local villagers. What was the jury supposed to do? Well, the judge had a pretty good idea on the matter. By the way, the judge's name is perhaps the most British thing you'll hear in your life. Lord Chief Baron Sir Archibald MacDonald. All right, when the manslaughter verdict came in, Sir Archibald dismissed the gallery and spoke directly to the jury. Quote, "I should betray my duty and injure the public security if I did not persist in asserting that this is a clear case of murder if the facts be proved to your satisfaction. A killing whatever amounts to murder, unless justified by the law or in self-defense, in cases of some involuntary acts or some sufficiently violent provocation, it becomes manslaughter. Not one of these circumstances occur here." Okay, he basically spanked the butts of the jurors and said, "Too bad for your feelings, go do your job." The judge argued that Smith had not acted in self-defense, that the ghost, even if it was a ghost, did nothing to provoke him, and most importantly, Mr. Smith did not attempt to apprehend the ghost without causing it harm. All of that being true, one must simply, according to the judge, insert the absurdity of a person pretending to be a ghost, and the facts don't change. As it's not illegal to pretend to be a ghost. Stupid, perhaps, but not illegal. Now, consider the actual events. Mr. Smith mistook Mr. Millwood for a ghost. Didn't give him the chance to answer for himself, didn't attempt to apprehend him without causing harm, and fired his weapon despite Mr. Millwood being unarmed. Further, the defense only offered character witnesses. Nothing to explain the events, only testimonials as to what a good guy Francis Smith was, and that because of his years being so cool, he shouldn't be punished for the death of Mr. Millwood. The judge quickly rejected all of that, reminding the jury that Mr. Smith's previous good character should be disregarded where the current matter was concerned. And finally, in a statement dripping with precedent that would affect British law for centuries, Lord Chief Baron Sir Archibald MacDonald stated that, quote, "The fact that Mr. Smith believed Mr. Millwood to be a ghost is irrelevant." The judge would only accept a conviction or acquittal on the willful murder charge, and only the willful murder charge. Deliberations got back underway, and less than 24 hours later, the jury returned with a verdict of guilty. Perhaps one of the reasons why they were so reluctant to convict was due to a strange and barbaric legal mechanism of the time that meant Mr. Smith was instantly sentenced to death by hanging, with the additional post-mortem insult of public dissection. Seriously, that was the automatic sentence for someone convicted of willful murder. But it seems the good judge had other ideas, and that he believed, despite his impassioned orders to the jury, that Mr. Smith didn't quite deserve that gruesome fate. Sir Archibald MacDonald reported the fantastical elements of the case to King George III himself, and lobbied for the verdict to be thrown out and punishment reconsidered. The king alone had the power to do so, and he ultimately agreed. The death sentence and dissection was commuted to a year's hard labor. Less than a week after the verdict was handed down, and before the king's commutation, the Hammersmith village shoemaker, an elderly man named John Graham, came forward and confessed to being the ghost. It seems Mr. Graham employed an apprentice who enjoyed regaling Graham's grandchildren with ghost stories that were being taken a bit too seriously by the kids, but still the apprentice refused to stop. To teach him a lesson, Mr. Graham decided to don a white sheet and attempt to scare the apprentice into submission, try to make him fear that he had become the object of an unsettled spirit's ire. And then it all just went too far. So, the case of the Hammersmith ghost was solved. A man was dead, and another sent to a prison camp. But the fallout from the murder of Thomas Millwood would last another nearly 200 years. The main question was this: is acting on a mistaken belief a sufficient defense against a criminal charge? In 1983 in London, a case came before the Court of Appeal. Briefly, the defendant witnessed a man dragging a younger man along the sidewalk while the younger man screamed for help. The defendant believed the younger man to be in trouble, so he intervened, causing bodily harm to the man who was doing the dragging. It turns out the kid was a thief and the older man was preventing his escape. The defendant was charged with assault. During the appeal, the judge actually referenced the Francis Smith case from 180 years earlier, but reached an entirely different conclusion. Granted, there was much less at stake, a black eye versus death by blunderbuss blast to the face. Still, the conclusion stated that if the defendant was, quote, genuinely laboring under the false belief that he is entitled to rely upon that belief and take action he or she deems necessary to defend oneself or prevent the commission of a crime. The appeal was allowed and the conviction overturned. Thanks for listening. Make sure you're following The Devil Within so you never miss an episode. You can also check out our socials at The Devil Within Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Until next time, stay safe out there.
Hey there, I'm Amara Kofer, and I'm the host of the show Black Girl Gone. In this podcast, I tell the stories of missing and murdered Black women and women of color in America. I want to bring light and awareness to all of these powerful stories. I focus on a neglected demographic and missing and murdered cases and send my love and respect to the victims. I recommend listening to Black Girl Gone on the iHeart app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.